Right. So I would say, before you reach out to any of the tools that you mentioned or the ones that I am going to mention soon, just do some reflections. And I'm not talking to you, but anybody who's listening to us or anybody for whom this could be useful.
Hello. Today you are listening to our first English episode of Love to Lead, the new work and new leadership podcast from Vitesse & Partner. Our motto is that we love to inspire and support leaders and organization to develop value-creating ways of working together in the new as well as the old world of work. I'm Barbara Vitesz, and I'm very delighted that you are giving us your ear and your time today. And today I'm talking to Gabor Holch, an intercultural leadership consultant, coach, author, speaker, who not only commutes between East and West, but also builds bridges and connects them through his work. We met in 2016 at an event as the OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and found out that we are both interested in the same topics, such as global management, where we both are authors on global topics, such as my book, Global Management, Dancing on Icebergs. Gabor has served for more than 100 clients in more than 30 countries. He is expert since age 4 and China-based since 2002. Working globally, Gabor is certified management consultant in English and Mandarin. His latest book that I just hold in my hand, Dragon Suit, The Golden Age of Expatriate Executives in China, was published in summer 2023. In this book, Gabor addresses crucial questions for international business. How did China become a key market for global firms? Why are most foreign managers unprepared for these challenges? And most importantly, how can managers, entrepreneurs, experts, and students prepare for an increasingly China-facing future in business? Gabor, have I forgotten anything?
No, this was quite a voluminous introduction. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast, Barbara.
Yeah, thank you for your time and thanks that you share your experience with us today. Is there anything would you like to add?
No, actually, I just look back on that OSCE meeting. I remember it was a very impressive one with HR people from all over international organizations and all over the world. We had great chats. And also, your introduction just made me look back on the almost a year because actually, on paper, the book came out in August, but actually it reached the leaders in September last year. So I didn't know that the times would be so turbulent and so much would change between China and the rest of the world while people are reading the book.
Yeah, thank you. And to get you know a little bit better, I already referred to it in our preparation. What three episodes in your life have brought you to where you are today?
Excellent. So to a certain extent, you already touched on these three episodes, but I have to elaborate a little bit for those who are listening to us. So first, that half sentence remark that I have been an expat since age 4. And what happened at age 4 is that my father, who was an engineering manager for a company that was eventually acquired by General Electric, he got a posting, an expat posting in Baghdad, Iraq, which was before the Iran-Iraq war. So it was a fantastic place, especially in comparison to my native Hungary. So they had more exports. It was Baghdad was a hub of international business. And it was a wonderful place to spend half of my childhood there. So I think that's where I became a cultural relativist and I saw how people live when cultures that are normally so far away, they suddenly meet through the forum of expat families. And I was one of those kids. So this would be one of them. Probably the other one is my studies and early career in international relations. So I studied international relations. Then I studied diplomacy. I became a junior diplomat. I was with the OSCE. I was with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. This is one of the reasons why they invited me to speak at that Vienna conference where we met. And that was right after communism ended in Hungary, the big extension of the European Union. And I specialized myself in the Asia policy of the EU. So this is where my East-West interest comes from. It's later that I train myself over to a coach and consultant. And then finally, probably the third one would be my arrival in China in 2002, which was mostly for personal interest, not professional interest, because I had been interested in East Asian philosophy, martial arts, history, movies, everything. So I quit my job at the OSCE, which at that point was more related to the Balkans and the former Soviet Union. And this was one of the problems for me. And I just took my two suitcases and I thought I went to China for a 2-year sabbatical. But then it became more than 20 years in the country. And the coaching, consulting and training business that I started in Shanghai.
Yeah, and now you're moving back to Europe, moving to Budapest and still working on global projects and topics. If we refer to the name of our podcast regarding new leadership in the new world, what should we know and how should we work with our coaches, thinking about different personalities and even different cultural parameters for each country? When I met you at the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, you explained a special tool to get oriented. And it was very different from other studies like Hofstede, Trompenas, Halls, and so on.
Right. So I would say, before you reach out to any of the tools that you mentioned or the ones that I am going to mention soon, just do some reflections, and I'm not talking to you, but anybody who's listening to us or anybody for whom this could be useful. Do some reflection beforehand on your situation. Because one thing that I cannot emphasize enough in an intercultural environment is that your current situation, who surrounds you, even your state of mind and your mood, influences the way you digest information and make decisions. And when people start working across cultures, it could be that somebody has, let's say, sits in Vienna or Boston or Tokyo, it doesn't matter, and they have just acquired a client whose culture is challenging and significantly different from your own culture. So let's say this Japanese firm or this Austrian firm has just signed a big contract with a big firm from Nigeria or Brazil, whatever it is. So just be aware that it's a mild shock that we are going through in this situation. They reply emails differently. When we go on a call, like a video call, then they respond differently. They speak when we think they are not supposed to speak, and then they really don't speak when we want them to speak. And we send them 5 bullet points and they only press 3. So this is the first shock. And usually I say, exactly as you would do in a first aid training or a scuba diving training or a safety briefing, breathe, calm yourself down, look at the objective facts, but also be aware that you're processing them under a mild shock, emotional reaction. I was on a call just a couple of days ago with somebody who had just arrived in Germany for a completely different Asian country. And one of the things was that her life is a complete mess right now. It's a huge cultural change. Her flat is not ready yet. And they are still moving in her stuff. There are actually repairs that have to be made on this flat. They are in the middle of the school holidays, so the kids are home. You cannot just send them off to school in the morning and pick them up in the evening. It is in Germany, it's the middle of the holiday season. You cannot reach anybody. This is really not the time to make some big decisions. Once somebody does that, then this is the heart and the gut. Once somebody does this little reflection and breathes a little and reaches out, then it's time to go to the head. And then you can look at Hofstede, if you want to, Erin Meyer's culture map, as you mentioned, Intercultural Readiness Index, all of these are great tools. My personal favorite is a tool that comes from the UK called Global DISC, because it puts together the behavioral element, the behavioral analysis of DISC with something that is very similar to Erin Meyer's culture map, and then you can make individual versus corporate and national culture comparisons. But very importantly, in order for the tool to tell you anything, you need to know where you want to go. So if you want from Hosetta to Readiness Check to Global Disk, they are like a GPS in your car. They can only tell you when to go left and right and when to slow down and speed up if you know exactly where you want to go. And this is what very often is not there at the very early stage. This is why this reflection is so important.
Yeah. And even if you go there with an international expatriate contract for 3 years, it happened to me as well. I came there to Spain with a 3 years contract, and I remained for 14 years. But at the beginning, as like every change project that you have in a company, it's the same with yourself. You come there and you are really nice. I'm in another country, have new experience. And then what we really know, it's you're falling down to the valley of the tears that you think, okay, I don't understand it. I don't know how I behave. And if we think about new leadership and new way of working, I think it's very important for everything that we reflect on it. I think one of the main competences for the future for leaders is reflection. And that is what you already mentioned at the beginning. How do you see the difference of working in the East and West, culture and business life? Anything that you would like to say, okay, if you go from West to East, or what we see nowadays, if we have more and more Chinese companies coming to Germany, buying maybe automotive suppliers, and then the company culture is changing.
Right.
What do you see now in the new way and the new work? What is changing?
Well, first, let me just bust a couple of myths about working across cultures, because there is a slightly different attitude from interculturalists, let's put it this way, people who are dealing with intercultural coaching training internally, HR managers who are assigned to these tasks, and the people that we are helping. So if you look at the material, even you read books by Erin Meyer, Hosted, or my book, for example, we are, of course, big fans of working across cultures and cultural understanding and cultural tolerance and using empathy and so on. We are people who voluntarily work across different cultures, and our job involves help people work across cultures. But the vast majority of the managers that we are helping, first of all, their primary goal is to deliver the numbers. Mm-hmm. If they are salespeople, then the sales numbers. If they are engineers, then the quality control numbers. If they are, I don't know, safety managers, safety numbers, finance, and so on. So for them, culture is secondary. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is you must do this reflection, and you must face certain facts, even if they are not the kind of facts that look cool on LinkedIn when people post about it. And very soon, so when I've coached people face-to-face, very often they self-censor, because if they discover something in themselves, in their relation to the given country, you don't even have to relocate. Because of virtual work, now cultures come to you. So you could be sitting in your birth city, but most of the time you interact with people from different cultures. So the first thing is, a lot of people who we help, managers who work across cultures, very honest with you, they couldn't give a damn about the other culture. So they didn't take that assignment to Mexico City or to Shanghai because they are passionately interested in Mexican culture or Chinese culture. They go there to work. And very often, eventually, they build up a healthy interest in the local culture, but eventually they are there to work. So what the company wants from them and what they want from themselves is that they fly for 10 hours, they arrive, they put down their suitcases, preferably they outsource it to somebody, and then they go to work, they type in their password, and they start delivering value for the company. So this is one very, very important thing. What I see, and not very happily, is that there are a lot of intercultural experts who force people to immerse themselves in the culture at an early stage. Now, the problem with that is that culture can be a distractor as well. So if you try to switch to an unknown language too early, or you try to pick up the routine or even the diet of a country, that can just divert you from your core business at a time when it's already upset, where it's already disrupted. And this is why, if you ask what is the difference, an element and often underappreciated element of the success of large multinational companies is that they create these relatively culture-free spaces. Mm-hmm. So let's say I work for companies like BMW, the car company, like Bayer, the pharmaceutical company, like a Japanese bank and so on. Wherever in the world you work into the offices of these companies, you will see similarities. They use the same software. They have the same, or at least comparable design. If I walk into that building, I would roughly know which way to look for the big boss and which way to look for the storage, because they standardize these things. And if somebody has been in a country voluntarily, like China or like a Middle Eastern country, then very often they say, oh, this is the expat bubble, and people are ignorant about it. But this expat bubble, without this expat bubble, a lot of people wouldn't be functional in that culture at all. Now, when you mention, for example, Chinese car companies, and I actually do work with their Chinese managers who are earmarked or already commissioned to Europe. One of the reasons why I spend more time in Budapest, in my birth city, is because it became a big hub of Chinese investment. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Chinese companies haven't managed to develop yet is exactly this, is exactly a kind of environment that would make sense in Helsinki and in London, just like it does in China. Very often, these Chinese companies retain a specifically Chinese way of working with hierarchy, for example. How do you relate to your boss? Spatial design. How do you deal with, for example, Chinese managers are obsessed with using WeChat for communication because they claim it's much more efficient. But yeah, a large majority of people either don't have it, never heard of it, or even if they download it, they are not entirely comfortable with it. So you cannot just, boom, switch over to WeChat overnight. Mm-hmm. And Chinese companies must learn, whether or not they want to, they must learn from the 100-year experience of companies like BMW or General Electric or General Motors, how they created this easily translatable space, mental space, communication culture that makes it easy to work anywhere in the world, really.
Mm. Now, that's interesting, because it's a little bit like the expat bubble that you say is like the third culture kit, huh? All these kits from diplomats that have these tools, how to move very quickly to a new country. And that is what you say, okay, the Western executives know this already, and that could be very important for the Chinese, just they move to Western countries and work here because they are lacking about this bubble, the support from their own cultural community. And interesting.
Mm-hmm. In the Dragon Suit book, I mentioned a case study about L'Oréal, the French cosmetics company, which has a specific policy of moving third culture kids. And just a little bit of explanation, these are people who come from families where the father and the mother were from two completely different cultures, or they moved around when they were little, just like I was, or let's say they were born in a family where the two parents were from the same culture, but you were born in a third culture and you grew up in a third culture. So L'Oréal specifically moves people where cultural agility is needed from this kind of background. But what you have to appreciate is it's an amazing short to medium term solution, but it's not a long term solution, because what can very easily happen is that if you create this community of culturally, very naturally agile people, because their personal history enables them to be cultural agile, you can actually create a silo that people all around them don't understand. So let's say if I am one of these third culture kids and a company like L'Oréal, but a lot of companies do that, they move me into, let's say, a Asia Pacific sales department where the bigger half of people are also third culture kids. Then I feel comfortable, I feel more productive when we do intercultural sales, but also I will be convinced this is the normal kind of behavior. Now, then I walk over to the quality control department, the engineering department, the graphic design department, where half of the people are not third culture kids. Mm-hmm. And then I will be very often when I talk to these people as a coach, I hear them confirm that those people are stuck, they are a silo, they should learn cultural agility, but actually they are just working like 95% of people in the world work in an office, surrounded by their normal corporate and national culture, in that order, by the way, because the impact of corporate culture is much stronger in this case than national culture. So you also have to develop a certain level of empathy. It's a little bit like a very tall person in the cinema, mm-hmm. right? So if I complain that I cannot see anything because the cinema is not neatly enough arranged, not professionally designed, this person who is 6'2", he looks at me, there is no problem, I can see very clearly. Yeah, but because you are a foot taller than I am, and everybody behind you cannot see. Mm-hmm. So we have to, when we are in a specific situation, we have to deliberately learn this kind of empathy so that we understand how does it feel to work across cultures without this kind of natural agility and empathy. That's the real trick of intercultural skills.
Yeah. But when I wrote my book about global management, I was thinking about differences in different cultures, countries. Nowadays, I would say, even if you are in your company, you have different culture between the different departments, what you already mentioned. Sales is different. It's more or less like marketing, but there are differences. But if they go to quality control or if they go to finance, they will have the feeling like, okay, that's a different world. So we need this in a little in the normal company and corporations as well, that we are always talking about. We have to somehow connect the silos so that people get to know each other and have this empathy to understand and to want to understand each other.
Right. So,
but then you go home at least and you have your home situation and friends and your community where you get your energy as well. So if you work with top managers, with executives who are working in different situations, we are 30 different countries and more than 100 different companies. So they have their, if you look at the new way of working today and everything is changing, and I think that you experience this as well, that it's much more speed in it, that is much more pressure on it. If you work with the executives, what is the way of working, or how do you work with them?
Yes, managers who work in this kind of environment, they are very often unaware of how much of what they are supposed to do is simply a sharper awareness. So very often I start working with executives who work across cultures, and I said, okay, I mention where we are going to get. We are going to learn to mentally map cultures. We are going to learn how to mentally connect cultures and develop corporate executive communication strategies so that you get results with people, manage conflict and so on. But first, it's very often observation skills that we focus on, because people are busy and then they basically forget to observe the other person, even in their own culture. And then, if an executive, I work with high-level managers most of the time, they introduce a new strategy, they delegate tasks, they give feedback. They simply forget to observe the verbal and nonverbal communication of the other side, how well it is received. I mean, they put their whole heart and all their hard-earned experience into the delegation, into the feedback that they give. And they take it for granted that it's well received. Of course, it is in the interest of the receiver to receive it well. So even in their own culture, they forget that those people have their own ego, they have their own interests, they have their own plans. So maybe it's not as smooth as they think. And then you take all of this over to another culture where a smile, if I touch my chin like this, that listeners cannot see, but I do, leaning back, leaning forwards, eye contact, the tone of voice means something completely different, right? So in Europe, we giggle when we disagree. In Asia, we giggle when we are confused. First, I spent a lot of time working on this, just simply observing. I think this is tremendously important. And then the other thing that is very important when I work with these people, when we work across cultures, is that when you work with these tools, where the focus is. So that's why I said that corporate culture is more important than national culture. And this is why I recommend Global DISC, because that can describe with the same visual language, individual behavior, national culture and corporate culture. Now, if we look at this and if we look at it very simple, as you said, there are these very simple behavioral terms like extroversion, introversion, high risk, low risk, high, what was the, I think your example was power distance, collectivism, and so on. Mm-hmm. So these factors work in individual behavior and in corporate behavior and national behavior. But we cannot choose where we are born. So let's say if I'm born in an outgoing, happy culture like the Philippines or like Spain or some of the Middle Eastern cultures, but my own personal natural temperament, my genetic code is introverted and perfectionist, bad luck for me. I still live in that country, so during my childhood and during my education, I will consistently receive negative feedback about my natural behavior. I cannot help that. I was just born in the wrong country. Or if I'm born in Japan or if I'm born in Germany, but I am a flexible, disruptive, loud, outgoing kind of person, exactly the same thing. But people can choose where they work. You know, so this is where if we cannot be ourselves, if we consistently receive negative feedback about our natural behavior, then we start to seek out communities which are similar to us. So nerdier kids find nerdier professions and outgoing people find outgoing professions. And this is the reason why you have those different cultures in the same company. It's almost as if the engineering department is all in any company anywhere in the world is a little bit German. And the public relations department is always a little bit Italian. And so on and so forth. And that we can choose. Yeah. This is extremely important. So as a manager, and this is one of the first lessons, you will always be biased. So one of the people I mentioned in the book by name is in ThyssenKrupp, CEO level, comes not only from an engineering background, but actually he was a metal processing expert. And he worked himself up to CEO from there. He's always going to be biased towards the engineering way of thinking, even if he is a strategic decision maker now who has to take a lot of risk, who has to do a lot of networking. Smart people learn these skills, but at heart, they are still engineers. They are always going to be biased. That bias, we have to build awareness about it, right? When you interview with somebody or when you give more responsibility to somebody and somebody is, let's say, disruptive, a little bit pushy and things like this, and somebody with that kind of background doesn't really like that person, but it doesn't matter because they can do something well, which somebody with an engineering mindset cannot do. So this is how I progress from awareness to skills. And then once we identify the right skills, then we start repeating and build them into new habits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we speak nowadays about new work. It's about a different approach. We have sometimes these agile projects and we have new ways of working together so that the manager or the team leader gets more into, I would say, like a leader as a coach, even if I don't believe in it. But you have different tools, so you make more questions, you bring people to the desk so that they can make the table, so that they can make the decisions and things like this. You develop your team in a different way to be somehow more self-organized. Yeah. And you are going a little bit back so that they get the stage to work more on autonomy and mastery and things like this. So that is the way that up to now I haven't seen in inter and global management training, so that they really focus on, okay, things are changing. We are more, if you think of new generations, they want to be really included in all the decisions and work on their own and self-organization in teams and things like this. How do you see this in the global context?
The way I see it is that, first of all, the way of working is always new because the world changes so fast. So every generation of managers at the company has to get used to working in a new way. But there are some very significant, I was born in the early 70s, so I would be Generation X, I think. And then, why? Is it why? Anyway, so the listener can do justice about that. And then let's say younger managers who are in their mid-30s or younger right now. There is a significant difference in terms of the self-organization that you mentioned, or you can call it productivity if you want to, and how you relate to other people. So first of all, my generation, a little bit younger, we transitioned from first learning to communicate with people as human beings. And then the skills we learned were transitioned into the digital space. Huge difference, mm-hmm. huge difference. Mm-hmm. So we knew what it feels like to stand in front of a powerful person's office with cap in hand, waiting for an hour because he's in an important meeting. Nobody knows this feeling anymore, right? We know how to catch somebody in the corridor if you wanted something from them. Young people today only know this from movies, even though I think they should learn it. So this is very important. And we are catching up with tools because we had enough time to do so. Already in the late 90s, we were working with digital tools. But we transition our people skills into digital skills. Whereas young people first learn the digital skills. Right now, so my own daughter is 23 years old. They started learning in school the digital way, right? When she became a teenager, there was not a lot of running around and loud music when her friends came over to study. They just went on an app and she was sitting in her room while she collaborated with her friends. So they will have to learn these skills the other way around. And it's really not easy, because I will tell you, a human being, when you want something from them, is much more intimidating than an app.
Of course.
So if you, and people don't...
Much more than
yes,
email.
Yes, exactly. So if you want a job, if you want a promotion, if you want to sell something to somebody, if you have a supplier and you want to negotiate the price down, a human being can be face-to-face or even on the phone, can be very intimidating. An app was designed to help you. It's not going to push back. It's not going to, unless it crashes, it works fairly smoothly. This is one big difference. And the other big difference that is more underappreciated, but just as important. So let's go back to the 90s and let's look at books like The Seven Habits. Mm-hmm. Apart from making money on the book itself, right? It was not the interest of the authors of the book. So let's say if there was a company and they bought a copy of The Seven Habits and put it on the shelf, and the boss fell in love with it and kept talking about seven habits. Okay, maybe in that book they bought a couple of hundred copies of the book, or maybe it was in the library and people picked it up, right? But Stephen Covey was not sitting at home thinking of ways to making people read the book in that company. But the apps that we are using today, they are commercial products. And the developers of these commercial products have a very strong financial interest to make people keep using the app. And when I coach people, I give them a little bit of tough love. And I say, sorry, if you become more productive or less productive, or it becomes an addiction which interrupts you every single day from real work, they don't care. As long as you use the app, they are winning. You are a great client. Yeah. And this is a new interruption in the new way of working. And it's extremely important because basically people have to look at it as very often they turn the whole thing upside down. And now they are working 8 different apps and they are very angry at a little bit older managers because they are not catching up with the app so far. But if you look at the productivity, very often can be extremely low.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily true that young managers are digitally agile and older managers are not. I think generations really, really have to work together in this so that companies don't just become good markets for the apps.
So if we refer to our main idea of the podcast to new leadership, recognizing also diversity within generations and nations, we may see young people in China watching movies, making phone calls, writing on WeChat and eating at the same time. I always ask myself how these young brains can process it. And as a leader, how can I lead my team to a high-performing team? As we said before, we need observation, self-reflection, a team reflection, and handling the overwhelming workflow. How would you work in your coachings and consulting to overcome these impediments?
I think the easiest one, what I usually recommend to leaders, is to use a storytelling approach to what we are really doing here in this company and what is the ultimate goal. So the ultimate goal is you, whatever you're doing, let's say, let's see three simple examples. Number one, you are a not so junior, but not a very high level salesperson, number one. Number two, you're an engineering mid-manager. Number three, you are CFO. What are you really trying to achieve here, right? If you're a promising high potential salesperson, you are supposed to sell. Who gives you that? Another human being. So this is how the story works. Just look at it, turn it into a Netflix movie in your head. You're trying to get something and the gatekeeper to what you want is another human being. Everything else is just a tool. You have your goal, which is an abstract entity, and you have the person who is a physical entity. And if you manage to kind of align these two, you're a winner. Your apps, your time management, the building, the suit, the car, the laptop, or everything, single meeting is just a tool. If you can sell without these, please do. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Now, let's say you're a mid-level engineering. Let's say the engineering manager. Let's say you are one of the persons earmarked. Next promotion, you will be factory manager. What is it that you're really doing here? You have to meet certain numbers, production, quality, and so on. Who gives you that? Your workers, your team leaders, another human being. Again, the same story. The abstract and the human. Everything else, the performance management system, the machines, the processes, just a tool. So please never forget which one, and the CFO, the same thing again. Now you know the song and dance. So the problem with the new way of working that sometimes people turn this whole thing upside down and they think, for example, if I'm a salesperson and I already sent you three MS Team mating invitations and you don't accept them or you don't respond the way I want you to, sorry, I tried. You are just a messy person. But then when I work with these leaders, we go back, it's like, listen, the tool is a tool. The person is the point, right? I don't know if the leaders, the listeners will know the story of the Procrustean bed. You know, it comes from ancient Greece. There was an innkeeper who had a hotel by the side of the road, and then people went in, and he had beds in his hotel, which were of a certain length. So what he did is that people checked into his hotel. It's an ancient Greek tale. It's a little bit horrible. But the point was that if they were too long for the bed, then he chopped some off of the legs of the guests. And if they were too short for the bed, then he stretched them to the size of the bed. So the new way of working has a real danger of repeating this kind of story. And I cannot tell you, for example, very often a young salesperson talks to me as a client, right? I contact the company and I said, I'm interested in what you do. I get a form, fill the form. The form doesn't work. It doesn't accept one of my choices, or I press the button, nothing happens. I go back to them with the contact form. Sorry, the form is not working. I get like another automated thing. I'm sorry. You know, it's a misunderstanding. So I always tell them, listen, look at your goal. and look at the person who has in his pocket or her pocket what you need. And you have to put these two things together. Everything else is just a way to get there.
Yeah.
Does this help? Right, right. Well, for example, Chinese companies in Europe, do you know how many conversations they hope to end with just download WeChat?
I don't know.
That is, yeah. So we are talking to the Chinese managers of this company who are in Europe. And then they say, well, listen, the Europeans, they are not responsive. Why don't they just download WeChat? And then we go to a meeting or we are communicating. Sometimes they are physically in different spaces. And then we connect them as part of an intercultural program. And the Chinese say, just download WeChat. And then I go back to these Chinese managers and I say, well, listen, okay. So imagine that you are an engineering manager in Copenhagen or in Barcelona. Could you please just describe to me as a story? That's why I said, yes, let's use storytelling. Just describe to me as a story. This person sits in Copenhagen or in Barcelona. What it takes for this person to download WeChat. And then after that, apart from work, what would they use WeChat for? Because it's really not easy to get onto WeChat.
It's not an app you just download like any other app.
It has a completely different logic than international managers start complaining. Then they start getting all kinds of unwanted advertisement on WeChat. Everybody starts, you know, in many Asian cultures, there is no demarcation between private life and professional life. So then they get these, from their perspective, weird messages that they really don't know what to, you know, one of my friends is looking for something. Do you know somebody? They really don't need that. And of course, if the same discussion is, it goes the other way around, then the European manager says, just download WhatsApp. Yeah. And that's a very ugly end to the conversation because the Chinese managers don't have access to that app. So this is why we're saying it's much more concrete than we would think. And then if we build empathy with storytelling, then we can start approaching each other and put ourselves into the other side and co-create a solution. Yeah.
And it's, as we learn from Simon Sinek, really start with the why. Why should they download WeChat? And why not using WhatsApp, that's in Europe and in US, the normal way of text messaging?
Or using downloading WeChat, because actually a lot of Europeans are curious about what WeChat is, but using that as a collaborative activity. So in this case, the story changes because as a Chinese manager, my job is not to tell them what they should do, right? In large organizations, this is one of the most damaging kind of behavior. You should do that. It is your job. When you have done that, come back and talk to me, right? But until then, I am not going to engage. Whereas a much more constructive attitude is, listen, you don't know what it is. I know what it is. I know what the potential of a WeChat account is. Yeah, sure. It can be difficult to figure out and there is a lot of unwanted advertisement on it. But, you know, you can go on a call, an MS Teams call, the kind that we are on now with video. Both of them have their phones. And by the time they helped each other download the respective app, it is a collaborative experience. Now, one step closer to each other.
Oh, yes, of course. And we learn from Simon Sinek, it is, as you already said, more about why do we do what we do? How can we collaborate and create greater transparency and learn from each other? And the question is, how can we involve the top management and the executives? As you mentioned at the beginning, start observing, reflecting, and sharing goals.
Well, the way you have to look at it, any tool can be used for many different purposes. So let's say you have an A4 sheet of blank paper and a marker, right? You can use it to create a chart for your colleague, which is going to change their lives and increase their productivity. Or you can use the same tools to create a sign, do not disturb, and slap it on your door. It is the important thing in a new way of working is to look at digital tools and use them in a way that connects people, not get rid of the messy personal element. Because I understand, I mean, I know young generations, they were built up in a digitalized environment mentally, cognitively speaking. Their education was very much digitalized. Mm-hmm. Personal connections are messy. But if some of the representatives of these generations listen to us, I would say, when I go back to the 90s, when I started working with large organizations, I will tell you what you need to the next level to start an executive career, to be a team leader, to be an ambassador for a brand and things like this. It used to be 1 out of 20 people make it, right? So you have the right combination of expertise and communication skills, 1 out of 10, 20, very difficult. Yeah. Now it's 1 out of 50. Yeah. So do yourself a favor and make mm-hmm. it more likely that you are a master of the digital tools, but you also have the empathy of the person on the other end mm-hmm. who is using the same tool.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Thank you very much. So, Gabor, our time right. is coming to an end. And so thank you very much for all the insight. It was really great to have you in our virtual studio today. But if you think about your job, what is what you most like to work with executives and being in a global world?
I'm a little bit of a nosy person. So I love being involved in people's personal stories. Those who read Dragon Suit, if they pick it off the shelf, they might expect a business book, but they are going to get a bunch of stories with very important corporate and leadership consequences. So what I really, really enjoy is, you know, I step into a room with 12 managers from different countries and different functions, or I sit down with somebody over a coaching dialogue, and then they start talking about why something annoys them. And they start talking about what their dream is, where to get in a month or in a year. And then I poke the conversation a little bit and they share with me what is their honest opinion about each other. And I just felt jubilant because human stories are so complex, but they are behind every single mm-hmm. one of our heartaches and our successes. And just to understand our mm-hmm. story, our own story, developing story, the way we would understand our favorite novel or our favorite movie. You know, everybody has a comic book or a novel or a movie that you just keep digesting again and again and again. If we understand our own story and the story of the closest people, we don't have the energy to understand everybody's story, but the closest people to us, those who hold our future in their hands, that is the joy of my profession.
Yeah, I always say that we never enter the river twice. The river's flowing and we change constantly, not being the same person in the morning, at midday, or in the evening. And that is the same with a preferred movie. If I see it again, it might be different.
But it's true about every story. So just take a good movie and ask your family, if you're watching together, or your friend, if you're watching together, to sit down with you and watch a great movie and 20 minutes before the end, switch it off and have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. That's what coaching is all about, right? So every story is an unfinished story. And this, of course, once you finish the story, you keep thinking about it. Okay, now they are together. Will they stay together? Will they get divorced in 5 years? Our own story is an unfinished story in the same way, but the arch is what we are trying to understand. And then sometimes in executive coaching to rewrite.
Yeah, so we are like guides in the process. In a personal process, in a company process, yeah.
We are mirrors.
That is like to be mirror, yeah. Thank you very much for your valuable insights into your experiences and ways of working with executives around the world and for being my guest today. Yeah, we will link your contact details in our show notes, where you can be found on LinkedIn, where someone would like to buy your book, and how to get in touch with you for further questions that may arise. And thank you again. And yeah, see you soon. We stay in contact.
Thank you very much. I look forward to hearing from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, that was Love to Lead, the podcast for new work and new leadership and for leaders and organizations in transition. Thank you for spending your time with us. And if you like our podcast, I would be delighted if you recommend it to your network. And if you listen via Apple Podcast or Spotify, please give us 5 stars. This will help us enormously to reach more people who are also interested in loving to lead and creating a working world in which we would all like to help the shape. See you next time.